I think we should be very careful about artificial intelligence. If I were to guess at what our biggest existential threat is,
seconds is a revolutionary moment.
The rocket cylinder drove its mill. I can give you no authoritative information either to their nature, their origin, or their purposes here on Earth.
Welcome to the Creative Futurism Podcast, bringing together the worlds of business, technology, and creativity. This is Kevin J. Anderson.
And this is John Best. You'll look at the world and the future in a whole new way.
Welcome to the very first episode of the Creative Futurism Podcast. I am here with my co-host, John Best, from Best Innovation Group. John, tell us a little about yourself to introduce to our listeners.
Sure. My name's John Best, and I'm a fintech guy. I do technology stuff for banks. It's somewhat interesting. Yeah, it can be interesting now and then. I'm also big into security and hacker dudes and things like that. And I met this amazing guy named Kevin J. Anderson, who he came on my show to talk about the world and how it's changing and how it's transformative and how the things he's written about has come true. And I was fascinated. And we just got to talking and here I am.
And for my own background, I'm a number one international best-selling author. I've written 140 books and 56 of them have been national or international bestsellers. I've worked for Frank Herbert's Dune universe with his son, Brian. I've worked on Star Wars and X-Files and Star Trek and Batman and Superman and a whole bunch of my own novels. And I also wrote two novels called Clockwork Angels and Clockwork Lives with Neil Peart, the drummer from legendary rock group Rush. And I'm a mountain climber and a reader, and I love movies and just all kinds of stuff.
You are a Renaissance man. Well, that's what you are.
Renaissance men lived in the 1500s or something like that. Mm-hmm. Anyway, John and I, when we talk, it's just all kinds of ideas bouncing back and forth. It's almost like a crossfire. I'm the creative guy and he's the business guy, but we both have skills in both of those sets as well. And we just thought it would be a really interesting podcast to do to discuss things like culture and creativity and business and the future and how new technologies are changing the arts and business. And a lot of times it's great stuff. A lot of times there is devastating unforeseen consequences. And we just want to discuss some of that, the topic, and see where it goes and make you, the audience, think about stuff that you hadn't thought about before. And we will have some really interesting guests who are either innovators in the field or people who have gone through major sea changes in creative things in the arts and in business. To that end, we've got our first guest on today, who is, I'm very excited to bring him on board. He's a fascinating guy. He's a good friend of mine named Doan Perry, who's been the drummer of Jethro Tull since 1984. And I met Doan several years ago, and it was one of these nuclear meltdowns of just conversation. Just every time we're on the phone, it's like, oh boy, another hour and a half just passed. And the first time we met, Doan, he flew into Denver. And he wanted to just, because he had read one of my books, the Terra Incognita trilogy, and enjoyed it. And I got a letter from him. And we corresponded, and we had never met, but he was coming to Denver to play with Jethro Tull at the Red Rocks Amphitheater, one of our beautiful amphitheaters. And we wanted to meet, and we were trying to figure out our schedules. And somewhere along the line, I just said, well, Doan, why don't I just pick you up at the airport, and we'll go out to dinner. And my wife and I met him at the airport. We drove him to a Brazilian steakhouse in downtown Denver. And we got there when they opened for dinner, and we closed down the place because we just talked so much. And then we dropped him off at his hotel. And then the next day we went to the concert at Red Rocks, met him backstage, and we literally shut down Red Rocks Amphitheater. We were talking so much backstage, they shut the lights off on us. So anyway, Doan is a fascinating guy, and I wanted him to be our first guest because he's got all kinds of interesting things to say. And now he's been sitting in the background listening to this very long-winded introduction, and I want to bring on board Doan Perry.
Well, hello, you two. Delighted to be here. I'm honored to be on your inaugural podcast. I'm surprised and delighted.
Yes. Well, you've always had plenty of stuff to say. So why don't you just chat with us a little bit. You've got tons of stories, but tell us some stuff about your early times recording and how it's all changed, because the music business today, and for artists and for businessmen and for touring groups and everything, is amazingly different from what it was when you started out. And in fact, we'll probably talk later about the death of the album and how things have changed. So what was it like when you started out, and what was it like when you kind of kicked back and sort of retired?
Well, I don't think I could in any way say that I've retired. I've just moved laterally into about three or four other endeavors, along with long-time interests of mine, but along with continuing to record. I'm not on the road, but I'm recording with lots of different artists in that sort of modern 21st century way that we do, which is somewhat compartmentalized, where I recently did an album with an enormously talented artist named Nad Sylvan. And he's Steve Hackett's lead singer, who's the guitarist from Genesis. I did my parts here. Tony Levin, the great bassist from King Crimson and Peter Gabriel, did his parts in New York. Steve Hackett played on it, and he did his stuff in England. Guthrie Govan, another extraordinary guitarist, did his stuff somewhere else around the world. And Nad did his stuff in Sweden. And you would think, looking at it on paper, that that really doesn't sound like a really workable way to make a record. But I came from the old analog way of making records in real time with everybody in the room more or less together. If it was something that involved vocals, sometimes it was just a guide vocal. Sometimes it would end up being the master vocal. I'm kind of glad that I had that analog experience, if you like, simply because, for one thing, it was, you know, before the technology explosion, a long time before the technology explosion. And so as musicians, I felt if I was going to get anywhere, I really had to learn my craft as best I could and really study. Of course, that same idea, that same principle holds true today, but I think people approach recording very differently. And back then, I mean, I started as a piano player and then really just played classical piano for a couple of years, and then drums came along, which is part of the percussion family, and piano is part of the percussion family. So it was an easy lateral move and a logical one. So I probably am one of those musicians who's had 50% has been learned by ear. The other 50% would be studying pretty hard. Some of it was, you know, teaching myself and out of books and all that. And I had teachers, and I went to music school and tried to learn music properly in the theoretical way. And I'm glad that I did, because that stood me in very good stead through my whole career as a performing and recording musician. And being able to read and write music in notated form has been enormously helpful. There's some musicians that play very, very well and have a great innate intuitive sense of what to do, but don't read at all. But for me, it was one of those parts of music that I considered essential. And I think if I trace it back, it really goes back to my interest in and natural ability with mathematics. Math was something I was always pretty good at school, and I realized that music, the theory of music and the reading of music, was really just horizontal and vertical mathematics. It's all subdivisions of time, and the way harmony, rhythm, melody relate is very mathematical. So reading music wasn't very difficult to grasp the concept. And obviously there's things that, in the way that you would learn a very long, complicated word, perhaps as, you know, four, five, six syllables that might contain a whole thought, you would look at a musical phrase and it would be the same thing. And after a while, you realize that it was more recognition. It wasn't, you weren't necessarily doing the math or doing the subdivision, because you could see an entire phrase and know what that represented musically.
It's like being in the Matrix, right? Eventually the world just kind of looks like code.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Then, well,
it's... And some people could read the code, and to everybody else, it's just gobbledygook.
Right. Well, you know, just a quick question, Doan. So being a musician myself, and I want to juxtapose the analog situation that you have with the digital. So here's the thing. My drummer and I were really tight. We lived together. We played in our band. And when we would record, you're right, we'd be in the same room and he'd be behind a glass drum thing, you know, to baffle the sound. But we could see each other, and there were cues that would come up in the visual cues that made things happen in the studio that would never happen, I think, if we did it today in the methodology that you're talking about, where somebody records these stubs, they send them over to you, you add your portion in. So can you give me a little feel for that, you know, with you being in both worlds?
Well, that's an excellent question, because that is something that I have learned how to deal with and to try to create. Part of my job is just to create the sense that we are all, in fact, in the same room together. And one of the ways that I do that, and sometimes where it used to be, you would go in and the rhythm section would track, and very often the pressure was on the drummer to get the master drum track within, you know, two or three takes. And everybody else then could, you know, fiddle around endlessly and punch in and punch out. I never had that luxury, because we had to play basically a contiguous take. Because, you know, cymbal overhangs and, you know, cut off lots of, you know, resonant things that would be a giveaway that you're dropping in and out. Today it's very, very different with Pro Tools. I was missing that element that you're referring to, John. And so of what I've begun to do is, very often I find being the last one rather than the first one. Let me preface that by saying sometimes it will start from a very basic idea that I am working on with a rhythm section. And sometimes I will go to studios and do things in real time. But when people send me things, I've developed a way of being able to respond and anticipate, once I kind of learn the shape and contour of what everybody is playing. And then I can react as really in advance in perhaps referencing something that they might pick up on later, or reflecting something that has just happened. And so by doing that, in a way, it's less improvisational, it's more compositional in that sense. So you're right, when you're not all in the same time zone together at the same moment, I did try this experiment of doing something through, I was recording out here and all the other musicians were in New York, and to do this long distance with, I think it was a T1 connection, but it was whereas when we're something like this that we're doing, it's acceptable if there's a 10, 15, 20 millisecond lag. It's totally not acceptable if you're playing music, because yep, Everybody's out of sync. So there's different ways to do that now. And I think that one of the skill sets that I've begun to develop is this way of interacting, either anticipating or reacting to what is there, and also gluing where everybody is together. Because part of the drummer's job on stage and in the studio is navigating this line between all of the musicians, so that if, let's say, the bass player has the tendency to sit, you know, middle to the back of the beat, or in the back of the beat, and the guitar player wants to play in front, you need to be able to stay resolutely where you are. That tension can be fine if you both stay in your relative positions to one another. When I listen to tracks that I'm presented with, I can hear, okay, maybe the soloist is leaning ahead a little bit. Maybe I need to stay where I am or adjust that. And sometimes I will talk with an artist and I'll say, because very often for listeners who aren't familiar with the recording software that is used today, these digital audio workstations, as their DAWs, as they're referred to, have a grid. You don't have to use a grid, but I've done that without a grid. And sometimes, even though you may not be deliberately wanting to play on the middle of the click, in the middle of the grid. You have to know how to be able to move around it, to move back, to move to play in the middle, to play in front, in order to accommodate that. And sometimes if in classical music, nobody is worried about the fact that the orchestra is adjusting the tempos constantly through a performance. It's very rare in classical music you will have something that, like modern music, where you've got a BPM that starts and it finishes exactly in the same place. So I will suggest sometimes let's move this tempo back for this section. Let's move it forward. And I did that live on stage with Jethro Tull. I had actually this little device that sat on my snare drum, and it was a real-time metronome. And to try to give you a thumbnail of that, what we would do in rehearsals, I would sit and I had a metronome that I counted all the tempos off. And I would say, okay, is everybody happy with this tempo, number one? Okay, we all agree that this is a good tempo. Now, let's take into effect that adrenaline is going to kick in at some point during the performance, and people might look back at me and going, geez.
Get better.
That's right. There were sections where I said, okay, when we get to this section, I'm going to push it ahead a little bit. Or when we get here, I'm going to pull it back. And I could look, for instance, I hope this isn't too technical, but just like if it's 120 beats per minute and I'm playing half of that, what I should be reading if I'm playing 2 and 4 might read 60, but I might want to drop it back at a certain point to 58.
So you like have a speedometer on your drum set.
That's right. But that also helped, because when a sequencer would come in out of nowhere, I knew that when we got to a certain section, and sometimes this happened in long pieces of music, I had to be right on the button. So if we were playing slightly behind, I would move it up. And sometimes I would get to that section and I would immediately change it, because that felt better to do that. But you have to have a reference point. My eyes were not glued to this, but it was, and you can certainly use it to play in all kinds of odd meters. You have to just get used to the numbers reading, 27, 48, 59, or whatever it is that makes up your bar of 7. And that ended a lot of discussions, postmortems about it sounded too slow or too fast, because they would trust in the fact that I was paying attention to that. And maybe they had a little too much coffee or not enough sleep. That accounted a bit for the variable element.
Well, it was also your job, like if the guitarist really liked this song, and he gets to the part where you know he's been looking for it, it's like almost like you've got some sort of rope on him, and you're trying to pull him back, right? Keep him in the pocket.
Well, that's right. And there was a I had a this was a light bulb moment for me in music when I was very lucky to play. There was a great session bass player named Chuck Rainey, who many people have heard on, Steely Dan albums and Aretha Franklin and just tons of stuff. And we were doing quite a bit of recording in the 80s. And at one point he asked me to play in his live band called the Chuck Rainey Coalition. And to me, he's one of the world's greatest bass players and just was a delight to play with. Now in the studio, we were generally playing to clicks and stuff. So that tended to be the governing factor, and everybody related to it as they did, whether they were a middle of the beat player, a back of the beat, a front of the beat player. But when we played live, after the first set, I felt like I was dragging behind Chuck. And I said, I'm really sorry. I think I just feel like I'm constantly behind you. And he said, no. That's what I love about your playing, is you play to the middle of the back of the beat. I play the middle to the front of the beat. And he said, I like that tension. And he likened it to two cars traveling down the freeway, one slightly ahead of the other, but traveling at the same rate of speed. As long as the two cars maintain their relationship and the car behind is not trying to catch up with the one in front, or the one in front is trying to lean back to the one behind, that tension can be wonderful. Suddenly I went, oh, that's, you know, the fact that, that because cliques were becoming more and more prominent then, that mm-hmm. not everybody has to play exactly bang in the middle of the beat. It's not even necessarily musical or human that we do that. And so when you maintain those relative positions, that wonderful tension in the music, which sometimes can give it a toe-curling tension because of that, I can think of loads of examples. Is that that was, as I say, one of those light bulb moments where I went, that is a, one of the most useful pieces of information that I was able to apply to what I do.
And I just want to point out to our listeners that for those of you who watch Spinal Tap and think the drummer is just a dumb guy who bangs on things, I think don't just kind of put that to to rest there. I mean, there's really a mathematics and a science behind that. What's doing it. And I remember, I mean, most listeners know that I've spent a lot of time with Neil Peart, the drummer from Rush. And we came backstage before a concert and he was going through an instructional video himself, trying to learn to get better as a drummer. And it just kind of blew me away. I said, well, what are you doing, Neil? He said, well, I'm learning how to improve my craft. And this is a guy widely recognized as one of the best drummers ever. And he's still learning stuff. And I want to throw in one last thing about the remote recording that you were talking about. First I ever heard about that was in a bad way, sort of the legendary Beatles album, Let It Be, that they all recorded it separately in the studio. And we all thought, you know, that's a terrible thing that they're a group and they're not recording it together in the studio. And now I'm assuming that's how most of the tracks are done on many things. So that's just a change in technology, because it doesn't really, it makes things more straightforward, because you have people who are in different parts of the world recording different things. And
well, and it mixes those things. I mean, these YouTube performers that get together with other YouTube performers I'm sure you've seen these types of things. There's magic that comes out of that when some other artist takes a Jethro Tull song and does something just no one would ever think of with it, with two other people from two other parts of the world. So I don't want to discount that. I was just wondering how you found it, because that would be the thing that I would struggle with, is without those visual cues, not only that, but the emotion of it, like just being next to, my drummer's name was Bim, you know, there was an energy there. So you have to sort of work yourself into this energy without the rest of the band around.
Well, think of it this way, John. If you had no sight and you were only relying on your ears, when I put on headphones in the studio and I'm playing to a track, as I told you, we tried this one thing in real time with the musicians in New York, but till they can get the technology so that we can do it with zero latency, that I just think of, yeah, the guys are just in another room playing. I just can't see them. And I think that when you remove the visual cues that perhaps you were relied on, you can still respond in the same way. But I take your point about, well, there's a give and take. Suppose you're just responding to them, and because you're the last one in, they're not necessarily responding to you. That is absolutely true. But I think that's where the artistry of being able to blend things that are recorded in different places at different times together and make it sound like a seamless interactive performance is where there is some, you know, craft and artistry, yeah, and letting that happen. Because in this world today, the technology is moving so fast that young musicians don't even really relate to the concept of like four or five or eight people all playing together at the same time in the same room. It is not something they've probably ever experienced. So I'm glad that I've experienced both ways, but I think they're all valid ways of making music. And it's like any tool. I mean, if you had a Ferrari and you gave it to a very inexperienced driver, you're not going to get great, right, result.
It's the difference between a shovel and a backhoe. You know, I tell people, hey, if you want to dig a hole, I bet I could beat you, because it'll take you more time to figure out the backhoe than it will for me to figure out the shovel. Right. But once you figure out the backhoe, you're going to dig a lot more holes. Right. But I want to applaud one thing, and I want to get onto this album thing we were talking about. So I've been reading this book called Mindset by Carol Dweck. And what it's about is a fixed mindset versus a growth mindset. And it seems to me, Kevin, that you've been surrounding yourself with these people who are growth mindset. I listened to Doan here say, well, I'm going to learn to read music. You know, a lot of drummers, that's not a thing. You know, we used to have the joke you were mentioned earlier. What do you call that guy that hangs around with all the musicians?
The drummer,
right. but point is that he has a growth mindset, and so does Neil Peart. He's backstage going, I'm going to continually learn. And the fact that Doan has figured out how to work with this digital model is really, really cool. And it's perpetuated his art, his craft, and probably energized him to learn it. And it's just amazing.
Well, it's kind of all of the arts. I mean, it's always a moving target that you have to keep pushing yourself and trying something different. Otherwise, you're that guy that just sits there, makes reproductions of the Mona Lisa and sells them to hotels.
Yeah.
You know, that you don't want to do that because, well, I mean, there's
probably good money in that,
I guess. But there's also, well, I mean, Jethro Tull and Rush are good examples of people that just kept producing music and kept doing interesting stuff rather than I've had my hits and I'm going to play the state fairs and just play the hits and never come up with something new. The technology itself has changed music kind of fundamentally in that, Doan, you and I were talking before, and I'll let you kind of retell the story about albums. We used to listen to albums, and an album was a unit. It's like buying a novel, that the whole thing, that there might be some great tracks and some like filler tracks, but it was still the album. And, you know, Aqualung is not just a bunch of little songs and Kansas Left Overture and Styx, The Grand Illusion, and Jeff Wayne's War of the Worlds. I love that one. And
Queensryche's Operation Mindcrime.
And Rush 2112. I mean, these are great albums. You don't just play track three and track five, but now so many listeners are just on iTunes and they just download this song and that song. And you were telling me a story, Doan, about it. I think it was your daughter's boyfriend or something coming in and had never seen albums before.
Yes. Well, I think that this also addresses a wider issue, which is the proliferation, if you like, of ADD. First of all, part of this goes back to something that you can lay more at the feet of current day media platforms. And I think attention deficit disorder is becoming more and more of a problem, not just with younger people, but even older people, because, and I will circle back to this, but it's salient to that anecdote, Kevin, because people are so accustomed to everything being these, whether it's, you know, Twitter and it's 171 characters or whatever, and TV and movies and, you know, so many quick edits, which probably was courtesy of MTV. And even books, this is...
We have short chapters. You can't have long chapters anymore.
No, and people don't tend to read as much as they did. In music, it's the same thing. This idea that an artist will make a record that is a linear statement from beginning to end, and it's been thought about in terms of how it's sequenced to give... And now let me say that I'm going back to the way records, and I'm talking about vinyl records, used to be made. They are probably made in a much more a la carte way these days. But what Kevin was talking about, and this addresses this point, is that unfortunately the attention span, if we're just talking about music, most people will download a song from iTunes, and that might be the only song that they have of that artist. So one day there was a friend of our daughter's who had come over and brought her young son and walked into the living room, and I've got a whole big section of vinyl. And he looked at those and he goes, are those records? And I said, yes, Harry, those are records. And he goes, wow. Like I've never seen one. I've heard about these things called records, but and I just sort of chuckled to myself. And he said, "Could I look at one?" So I pulled out something that had a wonderful gatefold sleeve, and it had artwork and the lyrics and the credits and who played what and the engineer and where it was recorded and all this information. So I said a very silly thing to him. I said, well, I suppose you're just part of the CD generation. And he just looked at me like, what? And yeah, what are CDs? And I realized, oh my God, I'm, you know, really going, you know, back in time showing, you know, my vintage, because he had only really experienced music one track at a time. And probably while he was on his skateboard with his earbuds in, you know, with a bunch of ambient noise around him. And I said, listen, take it from a crusty old musician. I'm going to give you a piece of advice, because his mother was saying, yeah, now listen to him, because she came from, you know, the era of vinyl and listening to records as an entire experience. I mean, if you want to make the analogy of saying you don't go to a movie and go in, you know, an hour into the movie and then expect to, you know, get the point of what's going on. You really have to see the whole thing. And I said, look, there were many artists. I won't say all artists, because before the era of what we refer to broadly as the concept album, which in a lot of ways I think of the first one being Sgt. Pepper, the Beatles were the original progressive rock group, made the first progressive rock record in a lot of ways. It was something that suddenly those songs, they did stand by themselves as songs on their own, but the whole album as an experience, that was the first time I remember listening in an unbroken period of time to a piece of music in exactly the way they sequenced it. And that changed forever my listening habits. Though I will say in classical music, this has certainly existed for a much longer time. Maybe, you know, there are symphonies that are 15 minutes long. There's others that are 60 minutes long. In modern popular music, and that was the popular music of the day, people also had the attention span and the willingness to sit through something like that. So to go back, I said, look, take your favorite artist that you have a song by. Do yourself a favor. Buy the entire record and listen to it in the sequence that the artist has chosen. Turn off all the lights. Put on some good headphones or listen to it on the speakers. Don't be on your phone or whatever. Just listen to it in a very focused manner. And you might find that the experience that you have as a listener will be forever altered by experiencing music in this way and not as just some background noise. Whether he ever did that or not, I have no idea. But that kind of speaks to that this epidemic of lack of attention that seems to be a growing problem.
Well, but your comments, though, about taking the album and sitting down in a room, those are mainly pitched toward like a Jethro Tull album or a Rush album or something. I'm not sure that current musicians make albums that way, because they know that they're just going to be chopped up into.
I'm not sure they even get to pick the order anymore.
I know some of them. I mean, in fact, Styx just came out with the new album after several years, and it's a big concept album.
You know who's been putting out a lot of concept albums? Is people like Kanye or Jay-Z. You know, that seems to be a medium where they do it now. But the things like Rush, they just, you know, I mean, I remember, you know where I exposed to 2112? Guess.
At a laser show?
Yes. At a Bishop Planetarium in Tampa, Florida. And we went to see it. And I had to go to a record store the next day and pick up 2112. I had to have it because I wanted to hear the story again. Mm-hmm. And then now, a part of that story has been immortalized in the movie that's about to come out by a great book.
Ready Player One.
By
Eric Kline.
Yeah. And so, but that's coming back. You know, you'd have to understand that whole thing.
Well, and it's branching out in different delivery systems. It's kind of cool that you can just go on iTunes and say, I want this one, this one, this one, and then get them instantly. And so, you know, it's nice to go down and spend the afternoon in the record store and flip through the albums. And I would keep going there going, I wonder if Kansas has a new album out, because you didn't get an email when they came out.
Yeah.
You didn't know any of this stuff.
Just had to guess.
You just had to keep going. And I lived in this small town in Wisconsin, and And like once or twice a year, we'd get to Milwaukee and we'd get to go into Music Land, and I'd stand there for hours at Music Land flipping through. And that was it. And here's another sales thing about albums. I'm a science fiction guy. I mean, I'm reading science fiction, reading Lord of the Rings, and I would flip through. And in fact, the reason I got into Rush was because I didn't know anything about them, but they had like science fiction-y artwork on their covers. So and if you remember like the Steppenwolf albums and things, that they were just fantastic covers. And now, I mean, even CDs, and yes, I'm still insisting on buying CDs because I like to get the booklet. But the booklet is pretty. You practically need a telescope to read the little print that's inside there. But
you know what my favorite record album is for art? The first Asia album. I love that logo and the snake and how. And then when you opened it up, it was brilliant.
Well, this is, you're talking about something that I think is maybe not as important as the music, but such a complement to the music, and the experience of listening is lessened when the artwork that accompanies the whole experience of perhaps reading along with the lyrics and getting the story. I also love knowing who played what, who wrote what, who engineered it, where it was recorded. Anything I could absorb was fascinating to me. So that was all part of the listening experience. And Kevin, I think you're right about something you said a minute ago, this is not the idea of doing things in a long form, if you like, in terms of connecting a series, a family of songs together, is not something that artists worry about these days. But and John, you might be right that perhaps what we're seeing is that is being utilized more by people like Kanye West or Jay-Z. And I'm glad that is living in some form, because I think that the notion that we live in this universe of sound bites, and we're so deluged with media overload. We all are. I mean, and the problem is I'm a sponge for information. I've always read my whole life, and just the internet is the most amazing repository of information to learn everything you could possibly imagine and things some you couldn't even imagine. And yet what happens is, then people jump from one thing to another. And I think 100 years ago, or even 50 years ago, or 30 years ago, the average attention span of people, because we did not have this daily onslaught of media coming at us from every direction, was different. People were able to focus for longer periods of time. I would like to think there are artists carrying that forward. And if that's in the rap community or in sectors of the rock community, or the jazz community. I mean, there's actually, you know, some, you know, jazz albums that are being made as almost as concept albums. And so the notion that will still exist, as books will still exist, as movies in a long form. If you think back, this is an obscure reference, but I believe it was a movie called The Passenger that was made in 1971. And it opens with this long shot that it's inside of a room and it's looking out through the bars of a window at some, you know, it's at some place in Europe, in France, perhaps. And suddenly the camera, where you're looking at these bars and you're thinking it's going to go up to the bars, the camera seems to pass right through the bars out into the courtyard. And the opening shot, or one of the opening shots, was this long, unbroken 3 or 4 minute excursion, a visual excursion that you went on. Now, you don't see that in movies too much these days, because people, or at least the big budget movies and the big summer blockbusters, are all, you know, it's got to be, you know, so many, you know,
explosions,
car crashes per minute, whatever it is.
CCPM is car crashes per minute. It's a unit of
unit of measurement. Yes. I remember that.
I'm in a class right now about writing essays and another one called flash fiction, which is like fiction that's 700 words long, and it's a new skill that it's been around for a while. But in one of the textbooks that I was reading, had a whole section on it about, like, in the early 1900s, there were not that many forms of entertainment or distraction all the time, so that when you finished your dinner at night, you sat down with a book and expected to read for 4 hours and just and think about what you read.
Yes.
And nobody sits still for 4 hours anymore. So therefore, you could get these Charles Dickens tomes like David Copperfield that the first line is, I was born, or so I was told. And then it goes on to tell the guy's life from the moment he was born. Now, I don't want to see Arnold Schwarzenegger in The Terminator describing mm-hmm. how John Connor was born. Well, actually, that might even be relevant to that story. But it's a different, faster paced immediate input, immediate gratification. Your ADD analogy is perfect, but I might even use a different thing. It's the channel changing analogy that if somebody sits down to listen to your music, and if you don't do something to keep them interested, they will switch to something else. So you are constantly trying to keep them interested and engaged. You yourself were also using MP3s and iPods and stuff long before, well, at least Ian Anderson, you told me about how he didn't know what the iPod was or why you would want it. And you found a great use for it. Why don't you tell us about that?
Well, and this also is kind of addresses something I wanted to circle back to eventually about you were referring to about technology earlier. You know, this is one of the downsides and upsides simultaneously of this technology. I remember we were in South America on a tour. Ian came into my dressing room and he said, do you know what this is? And he was holding a CD. And I said, yeah, it's a CD. And he goes, no, this is our entire catalog of music. Everything we have recorded to this point is on the CD. And it's in this thing called MP3 format. And he said, this is going to be a real problem. This is, you know, before MP3s took off. At that point, there was, you know, the beginning of, I think it was at Napster, might have been the first one that was the, and all these BitTorrent sites.
The file sharing services.
All the file sharing stuff. And it has ruined our industry and what, you know, used to be quite a reasonable income that would come from, you know, royalties, mechanical royalties, publishing royalties, has now really completely disappeared from the landscape. But shortly after that, we were somewhere else on tour, and he saw I had one of these white iPods, and he goes, what would you want with that poxy thing? And I said, look, I've got, and I showed him, first of all, I had like every one of our records that was on CD, and I tended to be the band archivist of you know, arrangements and stuff. We were, and I mean, we would decide on what we were going to do, but I had, you know, live versions. We would do different versions of things that combine different bits of the music, maybe in one longer piece. And so, because I kind of kept track of it, I would put it into my iPod and I had all of the records. And I said, look, you know, if we want to do this song, because sometimes we would rehearse something in soundcheck that was new, because at the time that computers came out, we began to input every single set list for every single city that we had played in as far back as we could go, so that when we got to that city, that we go, okay, what did we play the last time we were here? Let's do something different. So we had to, kind of not unlike maybe Frank Zappa's band, we had to have a recall of a lot of the repertoire, and the repertoire of Jethro Tull's music is probably at least 300 pieces of music. I'm not saying we were all fluent in 300 pieces of music, but we had to have some acquaintanceship with it and be able to brush up on it and then work on it and soundcheck and maybe play it that night. We would begin to adjust what we were playing depending on where we were playing, but the point of that is that he said, I don't know what I'm going to do with this. My daughter gave me this for Christmas and it seems like I don't know if he thought it was a toy or something. And I showed him, no, this is actually a really useful, practical thing to carry around all of your music. Cause I used to have this thing that was like the size of a, you know, pack of cigarettes. And that was absolutely marvelous and kind of liberating that I could have not only all our recorded stuff, but various live shows that I had put into there, as well as all the other music that I listened to for inspiration and interest. And the technology, Kevin, you made a remark earlier just about the recording technology and how that has kind of changed the the way we make records, for better or worse. Now, there's times I've done some records in, and it's a film score a couple of months ago, where we were pretty much all in the room at the same time playing in real time. But it, and it actually sounded just as good, but no, not necessarily better than the way that we've gotten used to doing it in this other more a la carte fashion. But I find the advent of all this technology to be enormously liberating, particularly as a composer. I'm sitting in my studio now, and you know, the last 5 years I've been studying orchestration very, very intensely, and I've been able to put together in here, before anybody could even hear it, a fully realized piece with all the parts of the orchestra being represented there, before anybody would actually play it for real. But that is, in the past, when I would write charts out for, you know, a band that I was working in, something that I wanted to do, I had to sit there and write it all out. And then, you know, in rehearsal, you might go, oh, no, it should have been a B flat, whatever. And you are kind of learning on the job. Now, this is allowing me to, sometimes I will do, you know, play everything myself. Sometimes I play certain things myself, but have reference points of things I've already played. And it sounds pretty much like what I want it to sound like, or I expect it to sound like. I think that's wonderful. And the fact that you have to learn a lot more, you have to begin to expand your skill set, because you have to learn a lot more about engineering. And so when people send me a track, there are times where it is easier when I go to another studio and all I have to do is simply play drums and percussion, and the engineer does his thing, and then we button up the file and send it off to wherever. And then there's other times where people send me things, and I am my own engineer, my own producer, and I have to play every part and do all the editing. And I'm glad that I've learned that. I mean, I think probably being somewhat relatively evenly split between left and right brain has served me reasonably well. But there's times where it's a lot more work. But having said that, I think that's something where some musicians are, you know, maybe just right brained, and I think Ian is probably a very evenly split personality of being left and right brainy. He can move quite easily between both hemispheres. But some musicians resolutely, you know, stay on the right side and let the managers and accountants and all that take care of all of the other details, which, if you've got the right team, can be fine. But I've seen a lot of musicians who, because they weren't paying attention to how the business of what we do functions, they had no idea where these royalty streams were coming from, what to expect, just being connected to the inner workings of the business. I mean, we say art and commerce don't always mix, and sometimes that's true, but they necessarily have to
That is what our podcast is about, that we're trying to mix it. So fits it. Well, and like the same thing for me being an author working for big New York publishers, but also running my own publishing house and doing a lot of independent stuff. We have to be a one-man band too. So it's much like that. We're getting close to the end, but I wanted to throw one more question at you about your feelings. I mean, iTunes did the, you buy the tracks for 99 cents or $1.99 or whatever it was. And that was kind of the solution to Napster at the time, that people were stealing it. But if you charged small enough amounts, then people would pay for it. But now that's transitioning into these micro payments like Spotify and things that you pay a fraction of a cent for every time that you play these songs. And I've heard several artists who are just vehemently complaining about that, although that's what the consumers seem to be going for more and more often now. But I think the dollar amount that goes into the artist's pocket ends up to be a lot less. What are your thoughts on that, Tom?
Well, it certainly does, and maybe non-existent, because I was thinking about this recently in terms of, you know, YouTube and Spotify. I mean, I do get royalties that are filtered through iTunes, but When I look at YouTube would be an example. I mean, I know that at a conservative estimate, I'm probably represented on hundreds of videos, some of which are you know, officially sanctioned and had been, you know, filmed by a, you know, a broadcasting company for television or whatever. Some of which I'd never seen before. I didn't even know they were being filmed or had forgotten. And then things that are, you know, so many records that I've played on over with lots of different artists where I perhaps had a royalty stake in that. And I don't think I've gotten, yeah, I'm pretty sure that I can say unequivocally that I haven't gotten one statement or one line on a royalty statement that says YouTube performance royalty or Spotify or anything like that. Because, and I know that a lot of my work is represented on those two and, you know, Facebook and many other platforms. That's the problem. I think that's an enormous problem that we have not worked out in terms of how is remuneration working, because you know those companies are making a lot, but I don't see any of that being passed on to the elite. Not that I can see. I do understand where they talk about. I saw some YouTube video where you're saying, "Well, I've got 100,000 subscribers, so that entitles me." They send them a little wooden plaque or something. You know,
you can't eat that.
You cannot.
Yeah, you cannot.
Yeah, you could not. So, Don, you seem like a guy that really likes to learn. So I'm going to tell you how technology is going to fix that for you. So you've heard of Bitcoin, right?
Yes.
Okay, so this has nothing to do with Bitcoin, but everything to do with Bitcoin's underlying technology. The underlying technology is something called a distributed ledger, also known as a blockchain. And what we're seeing is that it's an excellent way to copyright work and to track it. If you think about a ledger, right? And you said you guys are business guys, so you know a ledger is nothing more than a list of transactions in order. So every time your music gets played, it should go on a ledger somewhere, which is why you want to see it in a statement. The challenge is, where is this ledger and who's in control of it? So what's going to change is that you're going to be able to take and put your music. And when I say your music, it's going to get really wild. Like, I'll be able to distinctly determine it's you playing drums on this track, regardless of whether you intended it to be on that track. You follow me?
Somebody steals his own drum track from somewhere.
Right. So as I have the technology right now to go in and isolate one of Don's tracks. And if I isolate his track, I could take his underlying drum beat, use it in my own song, and move on. And so the new technology is going to allow us to take the signature of what he has, be able to detect it, check in this distributive ledger to see if there's IP around that, and then, one, notify Don that someone owes him some money, and two, charge them. And so this is already happening. So, for instance, in a world of Photoshop, I could take a picture, and I could go in, I could add a dragon to it, I could make it look so real that it would be very difficult in a court of law for anyone to trust any pictures. But if we have this distributive ledger, and keep in mind, when I talk about a ledger, I talk about multiple people have this ledger. So if I took a picture and I digitally described it down to the molecular level, if I could say, this picture looks exactly like this, it's made up of these molecules, put that in the ledger, and then if someone ever altered it, it would not match the picture, you know, the definition that's in the ledger. And so this is new, and I know you love this stuff, so here you go. I've just given you something to go brain work around.
That's going to help a lot of people who have already had their work appropriated via samples. This has been going on, as you know, for a long time. You know, a lot of different rap artists got in trouble for, you know, taking samples and not acknowledging that, or not acknowledging the source, or providing any remuneration either. So a technology like that would be so useful in solving those kind of disagreements. And these kind of things regularly get brought into court, and if it can be proved. Now, there's other things that then become a gray area, such as you remember the one of the first big cases that was supposedly plagiarism had to do with George Harrison's "My Sweet
Lord." Oh, right, right.
That they said, well, it's really
he's so fine.
Yep. But there's also things where, okay, when it gets to chord progressions or melodies and what defines that and what makes them so unique that it would constitute an infringement. I mean, I can think of there's a story that Ian told quite famously on stage about the song called "We Used to Know," was on the second Jethro Tull album. On that particular tour, I think that there was an opening act, and that opening act's name was the Eagles. And they used to watch the band from the side of the stage. And it was many years later that somebody pointed out to Martin or Ian that said, you know, that song Hotel California is precisely the "We Used to Know" progression, which is kind of an unusual chord progression.
It is, because it has the E minor and a major E in it.
And it follows. I mean, obviously it's a different melody. It's in 4-4. I think they, you know, but he would joke about that, and he wasn't really bothered by it, and said, well, you know, they could at least took me out for a curry dinner, but but he wasn't fussed about it in that way. So you recognize that somebody will hear something and go, okay, well, there's only so many, if you're talking about chromatic music, yep, that there's going to be certain things that are going to be repeated at some point, whether it's a melody, a rhythm, a lyric might be, you know, a little more specific. This technology you're referring to, though, could at least eliminate the gray area that exists in things that are actually something that somebody took from somebody else and then has appropriated and put in their own.
I could think of three recent cases, right? So Marvin Gaye, he went after Alan Thicke and Pharrell. Yeah. And Marvin Gaye's no longer with us, the estate of Marvin Gaye. And then that was followed by Marvin Gaye going after Ed Sheeran for Thinking Out Loud, which is, by the way, you were talking about that push and the pull of the beat. Oh, that song has that in spades. And then Ghostbuster, Susan Huey Lewis in the News, you know?
Well, but then this is another 3-hour podcast.
It is.
But just for me, and I'm the writer guy here, so let me throw in there the devil's advocate argument of, but creative people always inspire each other and take from each other. And you know, Star Wars took a whole bunch of stuff from Dune, and I happen to work in both of those universes. And there's all kinds of things that you can go, either you ripped me off, or, oh, you read my book and it made you think of something else.
And what Doan's saying is we can separate that. Right. So we can say,
is
look,
one thing and being inspired is another thing.
Right. And he's saying this technology can help you figure that out.
That's right. Yeah. And Kevin, to that point, you know, there was, I don't know, it might have been somebody like Stravinsky that had remarked about the fact that a good writers are inspired, great writers steal. and I mean,
well, I'm not going to say whether or not I'm a great writer. Okay,
I mean, what he was saying, he meant that, you know, partially, you know, facetiously, but the thing is, you're right. All of us, we don't live in a vacuum. All of us, whether it's subliminal or not, are inspired or informed by things around us. But somehow the filtration system, the way it comes out through you, Kevin, or you, John, or myself, or anybody who has some kind of creative personality, is going to be unique to that individual. You hope. I mean, sometimes there's things where, as you're learning your craft, you realize you're imitating. But then you hope to get past that point so that whatever you produce is an amalgamation of your influences, but not necessarily like any of them. And I think that you have to you absolutely being inspired. I've listened to so many people. I think, God, I feel like I'm just an amalgamation of all these crazy influences, and not all of them are drummers at all. They've come from different, everything from, violinists and keyboards players to, other drummers or percussionists or even vocalists, the way they phrase. So I think defining what that is, that's probably a great.
Well, it's probably more than a 3 hours. It's probably many, many days in court or something like that. But when I first talked to John about having you on, I said that we were not going to have any trouble filling up an hour when we had a conversation with Doan. So I think we're kind of wrapping up, and you were the best guest we've had so far, Doan. Absolutely.
Wow.
But it's a good way to start our whole talking about arts and business and the future and changing things. And we want to thank you greatly for being on our show. And we want all of our listeners to go and sit down in a dark room with headphones on and just play a good Jethro Tull album.
So Doan, where could people find you if they heard this and they want to check out other things you're talking about?
My website, doanperry.com. And there is, there's a lot there, but I'm also going to be putting a lot more content up in the next month, but there's a contact page. I only with this caveat, I did write on there. I get quite a bit of email through there, and I do read it all. Sometimes it's pretty hard. I can't really respond to much of it because it's just, there's a little too much for me to keep up with in my day-to-day email. But I do read and appreciate when people write something, and on occasion I might respond, but is a way to find out a bit more. I mean, there's lots of stuff out there, but there's all kinds of spurious information that maybe that's a little closer to the truth. But thank you. I'm delighted to be on, and I'd be happy to come back anytime. And I had lots of ideas about the future of where I see some things going that we didn't even get a chance to talk about.
All right, he'll be back. And we'll have these links on the website, as also links to my own website and some stuff about my current projects and some links to John and how you can get in touch with us. And we both do a lot of speaking gigs. You can pick either one of us to come to your, John likes to dress up as a clown and come to kids' birthday parties, I think. So
anytime you need me to.
So we'll be back again in 2 weeks, and we'll have another guest, another very interesting guest, which is a surprise. And John?
CreativeFuturism.com. Doan, thank you so much.
Thanks again, Doan.
Pleasure. Have a wonderful afternoon, and best to everybody out there in your audience.
You've been listening to Creative Futurism with Kevin J. Anderson and John Best. For more information, visit us at creativefuturism.com.